Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Virginia. Mr. Chief Justice, counsel is present.
Thank you very much, and welcome to all of you to this virtual session of the Supreme Court of Virginia. We particularly welcome those of the public at large who have taken advantage of the opportunity to listen to the court on a special queue made for you. All right, call the first case.
Lopez as personal representative versus Intercept Youth Service. Nicholas J. Stamatis, Appellant's Counsel. Jennifer L. Parrish, Appellee's Counsel.
All right, Mr. Stamatis, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Nicholas J. Stamatis arguing on behalf of Appellant. I'd like to take a time up front to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal before I begin. This case before us involves the Virginia Workers' Compensation Act, which provides exclusive remedy for those cases involving incidents of accidental injury arising out of the employment and occurring in the course and scope of the employment. In analyzing these two prongs under the facts and circumstances of the case at bar, the trial court erred in finding that the decedent's injuries arose out of her employment in three primary ways. First, in conflating the two prongs by using facts which serve to satisfy the in the course of prong as a foundation for establishing the arising out of prong. Second, in determining that the risk of premeditated murder and assault was a risk which found its origin in how decedent was required to carry out her employment. And lastly, in holding that premeditated murder nevertheless arose out of the employment, despite finding that the murder was primarily caused by personally motivating factors such as Dorsey's homicidal urges and his personal connections to decedent Lopez. For the reasons set forth in the briefings and to be argued before the court here today, appellant asks that the court reverse the decision of the trial court and, if warranted, to establish a more bright-line framework by which to analyze the arising out of prong in cases of assault.
Counsel, is Justice Kelsey. If I may interrupt, the trial court found as a factual matter, and this was an evidentiary hearing on the subject, that the decedent was particularly vulnerable to attack because she was in the process of dealing with a client who came to the door of a locked door. She unlocked it because he was a client. The murderer targeted her because of her place there and her relationship with him, and took, according to the trial judge, took advantage of him. So that's not enough for arising out of. I can think of a dozen cases where that would be plenty enough. And if you were in a comp situation as opposed to a tort situation, you'd be delighted to get comp in this kind of context.
Your Honor, while it's not before the court today, in the comp situation, it is worth noting that it was denied by the commission. In answering your question regarding if the premeditation of this affects the arising out of, we would argue no, it doesn't. It's clear from cases like Continental Life Insurance where the person who was assaulted in that case was the victim of a premeditated attack. The court took care to separate the premeditated design with the actual arising out of analysis and determined that even though they had used knowledge of where the person being assaulted would be and what they would be doing, that didn't necessarily factor into the arising out of because it was a separate inquiry.
The difference here is that the decedent opened a locked door at night to tend to a client of her employer, and then it was in that context that he took advantage of her relationship with her employer to kill her. So, but let me change the subject for a second. Did you appeal the comp decision, and was it a deputy commissioner or was it the full commission?
I don't believe the comp decision was appealed, and I'm not 100% about the commissioner because I wasn't involved in that matter.
Was that before or after you filed the tort suit?
I believe it was before the tort suit, and the two were running parallel. The comp, I believe, resolved it first, and then at the same time that the plea and bar was filed, but before the trial court had ruled on the plea and bar.
Was, you know, if this is not in the record, tell me, because I don't want you to answer the question. If it is in the record, let me know. You don't know if this is a deputy commissioner decision or a full commission decision?
Not off the top of my head, and I don't believe it's in the record.
Do you know what the basis was for which, whatever decision it was, whether it was a deputy or full commission, do you know the basis of the denial? Was it untimely? Was it any one of the other 15, 20 procedural defaults that you can mess yourself up on? Again, only if it's in the record.
I don't believe it's in the record, Your Honor.
Okay, fair enough. Then I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Going back to your question, however, with her opening the door to a client, I would argue that the facts in that in this case are very, very similar to Reamer, in which a customer of a furniture store approached employee-only entrance, was gained entry to the furniture store by way of that employee-only entrance after the door was opened by the plaintiff in that case, and was raped repeatedly. The court held that because it was personally motivated, that superseded anything which may have been argued regarding the fact that her employment required her to be in a position where she was alone for extended periods of time. We would argue that the facts of Reamer directly parallel the facts of the case before the court today and demand the same conclusion. And in fact, looking at the findings of the trial court in this matter, which, to refresh the court's recollection, were that Dorsey selected decedent Lopez for reasons related to her employment, such that she was put in a position where she was particularly vulnerable to his attacks, that Dorsey took advantage of the spot in which Apelli required defendant decedent to be, and that Dorsey felt he could use the particular circumstances of decedent's employment to hide his behavior from others and conceal his connection to the crime. If you plug Reamer's name in that and the facts without context, I mean, it directly mirrors it. If you were to say that Reamer was selected by the Reamer's sexual assault was partially, even primarily, caused by sexual tendencies of the assailant, she was selected for reasons related to her employment rather than the assailant simply happening upon her and then raping her. The assailant knew that Reamer's employment put her in a situation in which she was particularly vulnerable to his attacks and made her an attractive target to the assailant. And the assailant took advantage of the spot in which Reamer's employment required her to be, and Reamer was chosen because the assailant felt that he could use particular circumstances of Reamer's employment to hide his behavior from others and to conceal crimes. I mean, you look at the findings of the court and you apply it to that case and they return opposite results. And that simply cannot lie here. And the primary motivating factor.
Counsel, isn't there a difference between working with at-risk or troubled youth versus a general retail environment, though?
There is a slight risk, but the appellant would argue that this environment is not all as bad as the appellee makes it out to be. This is not a program in which these children are criminally delinquent.
Right. I mean, it's not a maximum security prison. I mean, that's clear. Right.
And this is not a case where it was an accidental assault. One can envision a situation where comp would apply if decedent Lopez, in trying to administer medication to Dorsey, if he lashed out and he struck her in that way. We would argue that that would be compensable under comp. But that's not what we have here. And in fact, the only reason why this environment was made dangerous in the first place is because of the appellee's alleged negligence. They should not be given a shield by allowing a participant who should have never been allowed under their own administration criteria to participate in the program to then argue then that his involvement heightened the risk for everybody such that it became a risk which originated inherently in the employment. That should not follow.
Can I return you back to Reamer? Our case is the employee is servicing a client, opens the door to the client, and in Reamer, the customer came to the back door with a ski mask and a knife and busted through it. Isn't that a huge difference to you? The only reason the decedent was in the presence of the assailant in your case is because she was doing her job. She was going to give him whatever medications he was justly entitled to, and she opened the locked door at night, which is darn dangerous where they were, and she did it because that was her job. But the person got killed, the lady that got raped in Reamer, she was just inside and the guy busted through. Why isn't that a big distinction to you?
Your Honor, it's because of the difference in the separation that's required under Virginia law between the arising out of and the in the course of prongs. Everything you said is absolutely factually correct. She was asked to do a job duty when she was attacked. But the court makes clear in various cases, Bernard, Continental Life, Baggett, that is a separate analysis, that when a claimant is in the course and scope of their job and performing duties reasonably incidental to that employment, though, that is a separate inquiry compared to whether the assault arose out of the employment. Did it find its origin in a risk associated with the employer require the work to be done? We would argue
But doctrinally, scope of employment is, of course, different from arising out of, and we've Bernard made that point quite well in the Quesadilla case. But when the course of employment is an attribute of the arising out of, then of course they intersect. I mean, that's not a doctrinal flaw at all. That's actually the way the doctrine is supposed to work. They are separated until they are intersecting. And once they intersect, the doctrinal intersection provides the scope. Criticize that for me, that analysis.
We would argue that analysis is correct up until a point, because analyzing it at the point of intersection and using that intersection to inform the second prong essentially turns the analysis into one of positional risk, asking only if the claimant was injured at work.
But no, that I, don't, is not, I don't follow that, because we're right on the nub right now. Positional risk is Reamer. She's just there. Had nothing really to do with her employment. That's positional risk. You won't find anyone that will defend this statute from positional risk better than me. I would not allow that thought, the positional risk thought, to creep in. But then that's exactly what this court did in Reamers to make sure it didn't. But the difference is she became exposed to the decedent because of a job task. And it made her particularly vulnerable to the assailant, particularly vulnerable. That's what the trial court held. So that seems like a fine distinction, but convince us that that's wrong.
There is Virginia law stating that just because employment brings two parties into proximity, that's not dispositive of the fact, it's not dispositive of the inquiry of whether an assault arose out of the employment. So we would point to that law on the subject. It doesn't matter
has
that
left the conference.
To introduce them. What matters is whether the risk of premeditated murder found its origin in how the employer required the work to be done. And regardless of any of that, if King makes clear that if there is any evidence as to personal motivation underlying an attack, that is dispositive of the inquiry such that it cannot arise out of the employment, because it effectively cuts off the proximate cause analysis that underpins the arising out of distinction.
All right, you had asked to reserve 2:34. We are having some technical difficulties that happen to be statewide on the Verizon connection. And what I would like to do is to, first of all, I ask, Justice Powell, can you hear us? All right, what I'd like to do is to stop this hearing and allow Justice Powell to get back on the line. I'm sure everybody would like to have the participation of all seven justices.
Good morning. May it please the court, your honors. I am Jennifer Parrish, and I represent the employer Intercept Youth Services in this case, where the trial court, after a full evidentiary hearing, found that Ms. Lopez's death arose out of her employment. We argue before you today that the trial court committed no errors and that their factual findings should be accorded the weight of a jury verdict and not be disturbed on appeal unless they are plainly wrong or without evidentiary support, which is not the case we contend here. The finding of facts made by the trial court, some of which were just pointed out by Justice Kelsey, are based on the evidence, and they are located on pages 255 and 256 of the appendix, which is the very short iteration by the trial court of the basis for its ruling. In that ruling, the trial court made four factual findings that we contend deserve great weight by this court. A review of those four findings show clearly that the court did not mix up or conflate the course and scope proximity analysis with the actual risk test, which was properly decided and examined by the court in this case. To establish the causal connection, I think we all agree with the law in the case before the court that can be done in an assault case in two different ways. One, to either show that the employment motivated the assault, or two, to show that the attack resulted from an increased risk or an augmented risk of the employment. The factual findings of the court, again on pages 255 and 256 of the appendix, include, first, that Ms. Lopez and Ms. Hickson, the second evening support counselor who was murdered by Mr. Dorsey almost 4 months later, were selected for reasons that were related to their employment. It wasn't simply that he went to a spot and found them there. The second finding, also on page 255 of the appendix, that advantage was taken of the spot where the employer required them to be in Ms. Lopez's case. The third factual finding, Mr. Dorsey knew that their employment put them in this situation where they were particularly vulnerable to his attacks and they were attractive targets for him. And the fourth factual finding, in Ms. Lopez's case, the fact that Dorsey was connected to it and that the murder wasn't discovered for quite a substantial period of time, which is why she was chosen in the first place. He felt that he could hide his behavior from others, that she was a victim that he could take advantage of and be able to conceal his connection to the crime.
Counsel, may I, this is Jessica Kelsey, if I may interrupt you, that there are three cases that the two of you have been debating on brief and that I've spoken with appellate counsels with is Reamer, Plummer, and Johns. Can you quickly, those are the three main cases that appear to be in the briefs. Can you go through those three cases and compare and contrast them as I asked the appellant's counsel to do?
Yes, Your Honor, may the court. If I could start with the Plummer case, we contend the Plummer case is basically a controlling case for the issues before this court. In addition to looking at the trial evidence itself that showed an increased risk of assault, the Plummer case has very close similarities to the complaint in this case at issue. In the Lopez complaint, for example, in this case, she's seeking damage because Intercept knew about Dorsey's urges and didn't warn its counselors. It allowed Dorsey into the YouthQuest program despite his past instance of violent behavior. It failed to protect Lopez from Dorsey. Those are what are alleged in this case before the court. Similarly, in this court's decision in Plummer, the appellant alleged that plaintiff was a newspaper carrier who was shot and robbed while waiting for newspapers in a dark parking lot about 2 in the morning. The employer had set up this pickup procedure for the plaintiff in the empty lot. The plaintiff sued the employer, alleging it was negligent for many of the same reasons in this case. Failure to provide a safe place to work, failing to protect. The court noted that in the complaint itself, which it was reviewing for purposes of determining whether the plea in bar was properly granted, the complaint specifically alleged, like in this case, that the employer knew about the dangerous conditions in general and had knowledge of previous problems at the scene of that parking lot prior to the attack. So the court in Plummer, this court in Plummer, held that the allegations in the plaintiff's complaint that are very similar to the allegations here demonstrated that the probability of assault was augmented by the nature of the employment. So we have in this case not only similar precedential Supreme Court case that decides that the augmented assault is shown on the face of the pleadings, we have even more than that because we have an evidentiary hearing on top of that where the court was presented with specific evidence that proved the augmented risk of attack. So that is how we talk about the Plummer case. We think that is really the most important case because it is similar here. With regard to the Reamer case that Justice Kelsey was asking counsel about, that is one where I think it clearly has different facts in that it was a personal motive having nothing to do with the job duties of the employee. The employee did not have to open the door. The employee happened to be there as a salesperson of a furniture business, a former person who happened to have been a former customer, but anyone broke into the back door and committed assault on her. And that is completely different than the facts of this case, where we essentially have a targeted employee who, by the nature of her job, had to keep a locked office for her own safety, but always open the locked office every time one of the residents, including Mr. Dorsey, had a need to be there. It was the job of Mrs. Lopez to make regular rounds of all the apartments, including Mr. Dorsey's. The evidence in this case is that after she had made one of those rounds, he actually climbed out of the window to conceal to his roommate that he was leaving, and then followed her to the office, where he then knocked on the door, got her to open a locked door, because as a duty of her employment, she had to dispense medication to him after hours. And then, of course, he came in there knowing she would have to open the locked door, all of which was a risk of her employment that was not common to the neighborhood. So it's unlike the Reamer case, because, again, in the Reamer case, there was no causal connection between this break-in and this assault on an employee of a furniture store, which is not a hazardous job in itself, versus what happened in this case, where the hazards of the job and of being an evening support counselor for at-risk youth created assault. The other case...
Johns.
Oh, the
the bank robber case.
Yes, RT&T, I'm sorry, Your Honor, RT&T Investment versus Johns. Again, that was, it's different from this case because it did involve someone who has to carry money for purposes of, you know, what her job is doing. But in that case, still, like this case, the court did find that the risks of the employment were augmented because of the duties of that employee. It was known that it was a habit for this employee to have to go to the bank to make deposits, and that she carried money with her. Similar to this case, it was known by Mr. Dorsey, who was targeting Ms. Lopez, that she would be there alone in her office, and that he could gain access because he knew that she had to keep his medication under lock, basically, in her office where she had to dispense it. So it is more like that case and less like the Reamer case, but importantly, it is like the Plummer case in that all of the allegations in the complaint itself show an augmented risk. It's almost as if the appellant is arguing before you today that there was no augmented risk to Ms. Lopez of Dorsey's employment, yet they're suing the employer because there's an augmented risk. So it's an inconsistent position to try to now argue that there is no augmented risk to the employment when the pleading itself asserts that there was a, again, a failure and a duty to warn because the employer knew of the dangerousness of Mr. Dorsey and did nothing about it. If we look at those two prongs that we believe were proven by the trial court, the first is that the employment motivated the attack by Dorsey, and most of the trial court's factual findings were on that, again, on that finding of fact. The facts showed that Mr. Dorsey knew that Lopez would be working alone in the office, that she knew he knew she would open the locked office, that he knew he could hide the murder due to his knowledge of her employment duties. You may recall that there's an apartment complex open to all members of the public, and only four of those apartments contained people who were patients or customers of the YouthQuest at-risk youth program. And in this case, there were only six people, including Mr. Dorsey, in that entire program. So he knew it was like, based upon his knowledge of her schedule every evening, that he could get her alone in the office because there were only five other people there in the program. It is also important to look at the facts that Dorsey had no history of attacking any other members of the public, much less in his own neighborhood, but only in a therapeutic environment, because he actually had one prior attack, which was also of a therapist in her office, according to the evidence. Despite the fact that Mr. Dorsey held a job in the community every day and lived in an independent living situation, there's no evidence that he ever targeted or committed any other assaults on anyone other than Ms. Lopez, and then about 4 months later, Ms. Hickson, who was the next youth support evening support counselor who replaced her. We think that that evidence, which came before the court in this case because the cases were tried together, is certainly a relevant fact that should be considered to for the argument that it's the person in the position of the counselor position who is being targeted. This looked as her as an individual. And if I could address an issue that Mr. Stamatis talked about, the King case, talking about a personal motive, the cases are clear that just because there is a personal motive, that does not mean that the injury did not arise out of the employment. It has to be a purely personal motive, and like in the Reamer case, before the court has held that it doesn't arise. In this case, I think it's clear that even if Mr. Dorsey had some personal motive due to some type of urgings, that his attack was still motivated by all of the facts that I just stated of him knowing he'd get into the office. And even as the trial court found, the trial court did state in its finding that Dorsey's attack may have primarily been caused by his homicidal tendencies, but that Lopez was selected for reasons related to her employment. In addition
counsel,
to...
may I ask you the same question that I asked appellant's counsel? Only to the extent it's in the record before us, is there any explanation of the parallel comp proceedings at all as to what went on or what the termination of any of that was within the scope of the record?
Your Honor, I don't believe there's any information in the record about that, but this is not a situation like in Plummer where there are two different findings. It's the claimant withdrew her petition for a hearing before the comp commission. So the trial court is the only court that has held a hearing on the merits of this case.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
The second assignment of error cited by the appellant is the, really it's a two-pronged assignment. First, that the danger is common to the neighborhood, and second, that the attack was personally motivated. I think I've already addressed the personal motivation here based upon the facts, but this is not a danger as the evidence was presented to the court that was common to the neighborhood here. Again, there was no one else in the neighborhood who had the job of evening support counselor that required this specific relationship with Mr. Dorsey of a counselor client relationship. There's no one else in the apartment complex, arguably, who would have opened their door late at night after 10 p.m. to someone who came a-knocking because there was no reason they would have to open the door. And again, there's no evidence in the record that Mr. Dorsey would have ever tried to knock on any other door after 10 p.m. at night because he would have no reason to expect that he would gain access to any other person. So we believe the evidence before the court, which should be given some weight by this court, was fully supported by the witness testimony of the director of the YouthQuest program, who testified at length as to all of the facts we're talking about today, as well as the 9 documentary exhibits that showed everything, including the timing of the attack, as well as the training that evening support counselors got when they came to the job. And it included specific training on the records of each individual resident. So the evidence showed that Ms. Lopez, as well as the next evening support counselor, who also got murdered, were trained in the fact that Mr. Dorsey and others had prior criminal records in some cases, or had prior mental health diagnoses. The program itself augmented the risk of this attack because 98% of the people in this program had some mental health diagnosis, including Mr. Dorsey. For all of the reasons that I've argued to the court and based upon the clear evidence that was presented to the court, we ask that this court affirm the rulings of the trial court, finding that the employment itself did augment the risk of attack and that it motivated the attack by Mr. Dorsey on Ms. Lopez. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Parrish. Mr. Stamatis, you have 2 minutes and 34 seconds remaining.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just to briefly go over the jurisdictional issue raised by appellee's counsel, we would argue that the complaint in this case is not inconsistent with the relief being sought. Much like in Reamer, she decided to pursue a common law remedy, which if both prongs of the exclusivity bar are not met, it does not foreclose that remedy. In going to King, appellee counsel and I do disagree on the reading of King. And I think it's a difficult case because in several places it refers to broadly, there was no evidence, as long as there was no evidence of assailant's motives were personal, it uses purely only once. We would argue that the existence of any amount of personal motivation completely taints the analysis, such that when the court found that the murders were primarily caused by Dorsey's homicidal urges, it was legally inconsistent with the holding of King. Because as King says, it doesn't matter if the employment augmented the attack or even if an employee was targeted because of a reason arising from the employment in the way that the job was performed. King states clearly, because both ways are proving that the employment caused the assault, both types of claims are defeated if the assailant's motive is personal to the claimant. We would argue that the premeditated nature of this murder, as well as the fact that she was found without clothes, dictate that this is a personally motivated attack such that it could not have arisen out of the employment. For those reasons, we would argue that the trial court's holding was legally incorrect, not supported by the evidence, and we would ask this court to reverse its decision. Thank you very much.